Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With the changes to how Canadians are able to access journalism on social media, you'll always be able to find news you can trust on the CBC News app. Get your news without restrictions. Download the free CBC News app today.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is being recorded at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, the 21st of December. Will the European Football Super League make a comeback after a court rules that a ban on clubs joining is unlawful? Conditions in Sudan's Jazeera state are described as catastrophic, prompting two aid agencies to halt operations. As Israel orders Palestinians to move out of the way of the fighting in southern Gaza, we hear about one family's dangerous escape from the north. Also in this podcast, protests in Argentina, but the president insists tough action is needed to fix the economy. And
well, you need to be mentally strong, you need to take fast decisions, you deal with high pressure, nerves and everything. You can transform that to the war.
The Ukrainian sports star who's moved from the tennis court to the battlefield. 2 years ago, some of the biggest clubs in European football came together to form a new Super League. The backlash from fans, governing bodies and even world leaders was swift, and the plan disintegrated. Now it could be revived after Europe's top court ruled that UEFA and FIFA were wrong to try to block it. The firm behind the Super League has already announced plans for new European breakaway tournaments involving 64 men's teams and 32 women's teams. Its CEO, Bernd Reichardt, said the ruling had opened the door to innovation.
It paves the way for the creation of a new, more exciting competition at European level in which clubs can determine their own future. All within the existing European football family. So again, the strongest message today goes out to the fans. Football is free.
Our sports news correspondent Alex Capstick told us what the court's judgment could mean.
This is a ruling from 15 judges at the European Court of Justice, that's Europe's top court, and they were asked to look at this by the backers of the rebel Super League, a company called A22. And having considered it for the past year, or more than that actually, they have decided that FIFA and UEFA, European football's governing body, and world football's governing body, have been abusing their power, that they were wrong to try and block the European Super League. They've threatened sanctions, they've threatened to kick clubs out of competitions, their own competitions, to ban players, all that from playing international football, all that sort of stuff. And the European Court of Justice has said they were wrong to do that. They were violating EU competition law. So in effect, this opens the way or clears the way for breakaway tournaments. The law will allow them to create these tournaments without being sanctioned by FIFA and UEFA. As you said, there are plans for a new tournament, a different tournament to the original European Super League idea, which collapsed after, 48 hours or something. That tournament involves 64 clubs, so it's a bigger format. But yes, so it's a blow, certainly, to the authority of FIFA and to UEFA, although they will claim, and UEFA has already done this in their statement, that it didn't specifically, this judgment didn't specifically approve of the Super League. It just said that breakaway competitions should be allowed.
Yeah, I mean, could this eventually lead to a shake-up of European football, given all the money involved? I know fans have already said they don't want a breakaway Super League.
Yeah, well, I think the fans were, especially here in the UK, in the Premier League, the fans were absolutely adamant this should not happen, and it caused all sorts of issues around grounds. I remember at Chelsea's Stamford Bridge, there were almost riots because of this announcement of the Super League. As we heard, the six English clubs, Premier League clubs involved, they decided very quickly that they will have no part of the Super League, and others followed. The only two clubs remain of the original 12 are the Spanish giants, Real Madrid and Barcelona. So they're still involved. UEFA has tried to head this off in the meantime by revamping the Champions League. That's a bigger format. That's 36 teams next year, up from 32. More money will be spread around the clubs in Europe. And FIFA has also decided to up its game as far as the clubs are concerned by introducing a much bigger Club World Cup, which will start next year.
And might this ruling have an impact on the way FIFA and UEFA are run altogether?
Well, UEFA has released a statement saying they're very happy with the way they've changed their rules to prevent any breakaways. And they say they are robust and that they do comply with European law. And they also talk about the football pyramid being strong and has the support of all the stakeholders. And they don't see that changing anytime soon. I'm sure this group A22 with Real Madrid and Barcelona involved will have a view on that. We'll have to wait for the details to give it a proper assessment.
Our sports news correspondent, Alex Capstick. Since a new front opened up in the fighting between rival army factions in Sudan, at least a quarter of a million people have fled the city of Wad Madani and the wider Al Jazeera state. The area had become something of a safe haven for people escaping previous battles in the capital, Khartoum. But now, with the advance this week of the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, it too is part of the war zone. And the World Food Programme has been forced to suspend relief operations there. Lenny Kinsley is the spokesperson for the World Food Programme in Sudan. She spoke to James Copnell.
So the situation is rather alarming. We have seen over 300,000 people flee mostly Wad Madani, but other parts of Jazeera State, many of them fleeing on foot. As WFP, we had set up an operational hub there where we were regularly reaching around 800,000 people with food and nutrition assistance. And now we have been forced to pause some of those food distributions in some locations, including in Wad Madani, because the insecurity is posing such challenges to our operations. And we are extremely concerned on the impact of civilians and also rising food insecurity, as Jazeera State is one of the highest agricultural producing states in Sudan.
Yeah, once hailed as a breadbasket, not just for Sudan, but for the Arab world, the agricultural schemes in Jazeera State. So this is going to have a short-term impact then, presumably, and a long-term one in terms of agricultural production and so on. If we start with the short term, where are people going now that they've left Wad Madani?
So most people are fleeing to the east, so to Sennar State, to Blue Nile, to Gedaref, to Kassala, so further east. But what is extremely concerning is how quickly the conflict was spread to Wad Madani, and the concern that it could spread further into these areas where now people are, for the second or third time, being displaced and seeking refuge once again. And what I'm hearing from my Sudanese colleagues on the ground is that nobody feels safe anywhere in the country anymore because the situation is devolving so rapidly.
And how do you go about planning to bring aid to people, actually getting aid to people, when essentially people are moving in all sorts of directions, on foot or bicycles, any means they can? It's not as if you have a target population all in one area, so it's going to be very hard to get food to everyone who needs it.
Exactly. That is one of the biggest challenges at the moment. After the conflict broke out, had set up operations in Jazeera State, did extensive targeting and registering people to receive food assistance. And now what we're trying to see is how many of those people we are able to re-identify in different locations and how we can reach them. For example, in Sennar State, we do have a hub also set up in Kassala. And so that's exactly what we were trying to do, is identify those populations and where they need help. But again, this is another challenge to reconfigure operations when we had already had to do so after the conflict broke out in Khartoum. But we're doing so as quickly as we possibly can. Luckily, yesterday we heard from our partners on ground in one locality in Jazeera State that they were able to carry out distributions for around 30,000 people in Jazeera. So these are small successes in what is a very challenging situation.
Lenny Kinsley of the World Food Programme in Sudan. As it prepared for its ground invasion of Gaza, Israel ordered Palestinians to move south, saying it was trying to prevent civilian casualties. Many ended up in the city of Khan Yunis, but they too are now being told to leave. One of those who moved from north to south was BBC Arabic's cameraman Jahed El Mashrawi, travelling with his family along a road designated by Israel as a safe corridor. He says it was a terrifying journey, as Marwan Nasser reports.
BBC cameraman Jihad al-Mashharawi and his two-year-old boy Jad. As the drones hum outside his home in Al Zaytun in northern Gaza, he tries to take his children's attention away from fear by baking bread. But on the 13th of October, the Israeli military dropped leaflets ordering over a million residents in northern Gaza to move south.
All my BBC colleagues had already fled south. They told me how bad the situation was. No electricity, no water. I didn't want to go. I wanted to delay the suffering my family would have to face for as long as possible.
Jihad's mother, distraught at the prospect of leaving her home.
But the houses opposite our home were being bombed one after another. I had already lost one son. I couldn't risk losing another.
Jihad, his wife, four sons, and elderly parents leave their home.
In the rush to go, we didn't even close our front door. Then we started our journey through hell.
They walk to the route connecting North and South Gaza, Salahuddin Road. Sometimes it's nothing more than a dirt track lined by war-damaged buildings. The route had been declared a safe corridor by the Israeli Defense Forces.
There were Israeli soldiers stationed in demolished buildings along the road. We walked for hours and knew eventually we'd have to cross the Israeli army's checkpoint. We were nervous. My children kept asking, what will the soldiers do to us? We came to a stop about a kilometer from the checkpoint itself, joining a long queue of people that stretched across the entire width of the road. We spent more than 4 hours waiting. People were crying, and there was no room to sit down. My father fainted, and we had to hold him up. When we entered the checkpoint, it felt like Judgment Day. I saw about 50 people in total get detained, all men. They were asked to strip to their underwear and sit on the ground.
The Israeli Defense Forces told the BBC,
individuals suspected of affiliations with terrorist organizations are detained for preliminary inquiries. And if they remain suspects, they are transferred to Israel. Others are promptly released. Clothes have to be removed to check for weapons, and those detained are clothed as soon as possible.
A few meters beyond the checkpoint, I saw four detainees in their underwear being blindfolded. Beside the demolished building, there was a wall of sand. The blindfolded men were taken to the sand hill by soldiers, and then took steps down out of my vision. Then we heard gunfire. I'm not sure whether they were shot or not.
The IDF said,
the sound of gunfire is heard throughout the combat area. Therefore, it does not constitute an indication of shooting from a specific place of a certain type.
Further along the road, I saw about 10 bodies on the ground. I screamed at the top of my lungs, telling my children not to look. I told them to look at the sky and continue walking. Then an Israeli tank appeared. It was moving towards us at speed. In our fright to get away, we had to trample over those bodies.
The IDF said,
tanks move along routes that intersect with the Salah al-Din Road. There is no case in which tanks move towards civilians moving from north to south along the humanitarian corridor.
The family reached Nusayrat camp. It's so busy, they are forced to sleep on the side of the road.
The weather was freezing. It was the coldest night I've ever experienced in my life. I had to take off my shirt to cover my youngest boy, Jad. The next morning, we set off early for Khan Yunis, taking a donkey cart ride for some of the journey. At Deir al-Balah, we got on a bus with a capacity for 20. there wasn't enough room for us, so some of us clung to the doors and windows.
The next day, Jihad and his family reach Khan Yunis. He reunites with his BBC colleagues. Following a bombing, Jihad and his family decide to head further south to Rafah.
I knew there'd be nowhere safe. I knew that the ground operation would move towards Khan Yunis. In Rafah, we are renting a small outhouse. The roof is made of tin and plastic bags. If shrapnel falls, there's nothing to protect us. We have hardly anything to eat and nowhere to go. All I want to do now is leave Gaza and be safe with my children.
A report by Marwa Nasser. 137 Israeli soldiers have now died in the fighting in Gaza. That's on top of the nearly 400 security personnel and some 800 civilians killed in southern Israel in the Hamas attacks of the 7th of October, according to a tally by the AFP news agency. Around 240 people were also taken hostage, with 80 released last month as part of a deal with Hamas. The US President Joe Biden says he is pushing for another exchange. But today, Hamas said the Palestinians reject negotiations unless there's a full cessation of what it called Israeli aggression. But while the diplomacy stalls, conditions in Gaza continue to get worse. Imogen Folks reports on the latest assessment from the World Health Organization.
The WHO says hospitals in northern Gaza have become hospices where people are simply waiting to die. With no surgical capacity left, patients with serious injuries, perhaps requiring amputation, now risk dying of wound infections. The WHO also reported severe shortages of food and water, describing meeting people with life-threatening untreated injuries who begged not for medicine, but for water. The WHO would like to evacuate many more patients out of Gaza for treatment in Egypt or other countries.
Imogen Folks reporting. And from the fighting in Gaza, we move to the war in Ukraine. And the first tennis Grand Slam of the new year begins soon in Australia. Not so long ago, it would have featured the one-time world number 13, Alex Dolgopolov, who once reached the quarterfinals. During his career, he won more than $7.5 million in prize money, so he could be living a very comfortable life. But instead, he chose to join the Ukrainian army. Gary Richardson asked him why.
It's my home, and it just happened like that. You know, I came to Ukraine 2 weeks after the big invasion started and was here getting to know people and just happened to meet a commander. We got friends, and then just casually I joined.
And what's the last year been like for you?
Tough. We've had guys injured, we've had missions. I had some time to have rest, but yeah, it's been tough on the battlefield the last year, I would say. We didn't have big successes, didn't have big losses in terms of territories as well, but yeah, it's not been easy.
Can you tell me about some of the attacks that you came under?
Mostly it's artillery fire, sometimes aircraft. Mostly it's artillery working, and that's the main danger.
There was an occasion where I think possibly mortars, though, landed reasonably close to you. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. That was the worst, probably. They started firing. We had to go in the trench because we were working out of the trench at that moment and sit it out and just wait, hope it doesn't land exactly in the trench.
What have you been told about how the war's going? What do you know?
We're told what they want us to hear, but we analyze by ourselves. At the moment, mathematically, we're not in a good position. On the battlefield, they have advantages in most of everything. They have more people, they still have more armor, they have more artillery rounds. Hopefully, the world understands this and we get what we need.
Is the world doing enough to help you?
No, I don't think so. I think it's obvious by now. We read all the news. We see what's on the battlefield. We see the math of all of this. It's not enough.
You say that as a former tennis player, perhaps the lessons that you learned from sport can sometimes help you in the conflict. Just explain that.
Yeah, for sure, because tennis is a small war as well. You know, you need to be mentally strong. You need to take fast decisions. You deal with high pressure, nerves and everything. You can transform that to the war as well in another way. But still, I believe for me, it's a little bit easier than just a regular person.
Ukrainian tennis player turned soldier Alex Dolhopolov. And still to come on the Global News Podcast, a warning for those drinking fizz this Christmas.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland and its legendary Gaelic football team.
They've come to see the game of the year.
The year is 1951, and County Mayo have just won the sport's biggest prize. But in the midst of such elation, there's a funeral. And for the priest leading the congregation, this sacrilege must be punished. A curse exits his lips.
Damnation be upon every one of you.
It came to pass.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Thousands of people in Argentina took to the streets of Buenos Aires on Wednesday evening to protest against the new government's shock therapy aimed at rescuing the economy. The new president, Javier Milei, announced sweeping economic reforms, including plans to privatise state-run companies and slash government regulation. In a TV address, he said he would restore Argentina's financial power after a century of decline.
Over the last 100 years, politicians have been busy expanding the power of the state at the expense of decent Argentinians. This expansion of the state has been accompanied by the greatest destruction of wealth in a country ever recorded. Our country, which at the beginning of the 20th century was the world's leading power, has become embroiled over the last 100 years in an endless cycle of crisis, all stemming from the same cause, fiscal deficit.
Our business correspondent Monica Miller told us more about Mr. Milei's reforms.
We didn't get a whole lot of details. I mean, he said that he wants to eliminate or change more than 300 rules via this presidential decree. But some of them did include changes on rent, energy subsidies and labor practices. You know, and even since his inauguration on the 10th of December, he has come in and has followed through on many of his campaign promises to really change the way the economy works. And one of them is by devaluing its local currency, the peso, by over 50%.
And how much difference has that made in terms of perception of the markets?
You know, investors seemed happy. These are drastic steps. And clearly from the protesters, you know, not everyone is happy about the changes that are being made. But in some of the analysts that we have spoken to, they said that, you know, it's basically a house on fire and they really have no choice but to make some dramatic changes. Argentina is Latin America's third biggest economy, but it has really fallen on hard times for a while now in terms of its debt levels and just financial mismanagement over the years. Its inflation has surpassed 160%. I mean, one in four Argentinians live in poverty. So they are really struggling to get by at this point. The economy is shrinking, and part of that has to do because of a drought. A good chunk of its economy comes from grain exports, and that's to places like China. So, you know, they're looking at some drastic measures in terms of hiking taxes for grain exports, which could bring in some revenue but make some of their friends rather unhappy.
We heard the protesters there on the streets. What specifically are they worried about with these reforms?
A lot of these protesters were there representing the unemployed. Especially young people are very concerned. There were rent subsidies and some other things that they were really relying on. And it's very hard to find a job right now. So it's hard to manage both making some real serious trims in the economy, especially when it cuts back on social services, and people who can't really afford to eat or put a roof over their heads.
Now, Javier Milei is a populist. Has he said anything about how he will respond to the protesters?
He's going ahead with this plan. You know, when he was on the campaign trail, he didn't really mince words, so to speak. He's quite a character. You know, he called himself the king of the jungle, and he carried a chainsaw around with him at some of these events as a symbol of his plan to cut that spending. And he really went after, as we had just heard, what he called corrupt politicians. So he is not really backing down a whole lot.
Our business correspondent, Monica Miller. Today marks the 35th anniversary of the Lockerbie bombing, when Pan Am Flight 103 from London to New York was blown out of the sky. 259 people on board and 11 people on the ground were killed. Among the dead was 23-year-old Flora, daughter of Dr. Jim Swire, who went on to become a spokesman for the victims' families in Britain. He became convinced over the years that the claim that Libya was involved is false. Dr. Swire has been talking to Justin Webb. He began by speaking about his daughter.
Flora was a brilliant student. She decided off her own bat without any encouragement from me to read medicine, which she did at Nottingham. And she came out top of her year and so on. And by the time of Lockerbie, she had met a nice American guy, and she was on her way to visit him for Christmas when she was brutally murdered with all those other people. And that is the intrinsic sadness of this, is when somebody close is murdered like that, the family are issued with a lifetime sentence of bereavement, which they can't get over. And I came across Shakespeare's play Hamlet, and it's Hamlet at the end of the play saying to Horatio, "In this harsh world, draw thy breath in pain to tell my story." And the story of Lockerbie has become a secondary, smaller tragedy in the fact that we have been thwarted at every turn for 35 years about being allowed to see the truth that our government knows about the disaster. And that is a tragedy in itself, because it cripples chances that we might have had in our search for the truth, perhaps even to forgive those who are really responsible.
You've described in moving terms the impact that this has had, obviously, on your daughter and on the other people killed, but also on their families. Have governments stepped up, done what they needed to do to support you and to find out what happened?
In terms of the British government, I think they've tried to do what the American government wanted them to do, that is to say, to handle the atrocity in a way which suited American international political needs. And I'm sorry to say that I'm not aware that our own government had the guts to steer clear of what America wanted and to actually tell their individual citizens, like me and like the families of all the others, and tell them what they knew about what really happened.
Do they know, do you think, what really happened?
Oh, I think they know a great deal. And to this day, unlike all the other tragedies in this country, there has been no objective inquiry. Because unless we feel that will happen at some point, I personally will feel I have failed the memory of the horrible death of my lovely daughter Flora and all those other people who lost their lives in that crash as well. I hope that will happen one day, but I don't any longer believe I'll be on the planet to see it happen.
Dr. Jim Swire. You're listening to the Global News Podcast. Next, to a sound which could be pretty common around Christmas. Well, that noise will also punctuate some office parties at this time of year. And one of our Global News Podcast reporters, Will Chalk, joined me in the studio with a bottle of Prosecco. I asked him why.
Well, sadly not, Ollie, to celebrate the culmination of another great half hour of your broadcasting, but because of a warning from scientists at the University of Cambridge, specifically the Department of Ophthalmology. Now, obviously, in the next week or so, a huge number of bottles like this one, which I actually found under a manager's desk, are going to be popped around the world. But writing in the British Medical Journal, researchers say cork injuries can provide a substantial threat to eye health. They claim the pressure in a standard bottle of champagne is around three times that of a car tyre, and that means the cork can fly out at up to 80 kilometres an hour, which makes the blinking reflex ineffective.
So it can't protect you, and then therefore you get hit, which is painful and dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, this might sound like a bit of a non-issue, but apparently it's not. The researchers don't give much of a sense of scale, but they point to the case of cyclist Binyam Girmay, who opened a bottle of champagne on the winner's podium at the Giro d'Italia. It hit him in the eye and he had to withdraw from the next stage. I did a quick Google search to find a couple of other examples, and Theo Campbell, who featured on British reality TV show Love Island, had to have surgery after it happened to him in Ibiza in 2019.
Within a split second, I turn around, I'm facing downwards. Absolute bullseye shot. It hits me clean in the eye. And that's how easy it was. I took my glasses off for a second. I don't like being around these champagne sprays anyway, just in case it hits you in the eye, and it actually happened.
Well, according to a study in 2005, in about a quarter of cases, the person struck remains legally blind.
Will Chalk reporting. Finally, to a tip that maybe helps your Christmas season become a little less stressful, from the BBC's Rachel Burden.
So, this was just a moment of inspiration I had when I realised I had a lot of things to wrap and very little time, and I have sometimes quite small presents. And the thing that really takes up a lot of time in the wrapping is you wrap a present and then you go to the wrapping paper and you get it and then you cut it and then you wrap it, right? Now, if you're down on the floor, if you pre-cut your wrapping paper into small, medium and large sizes, spend about 15, 20 minutes doing that, then I'm telling you the speed at which you can select the appropriate size of wrapping paper, get it around that gift, sellotape it up, bang into the bag, done, is unbelievable.
Rachel Burden, not quite sure about that. We just reused the same festive gift bags from last year. Bah humbug. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Vladimir Mozechka. The producer was Tracy Gordon. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.